The Guardian.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. On the show this week, are we surrounded by a huge number of parallel universes? Is there an infinite cycle of Big Bangs? Do new universes spring up in the gaps as our own universe expands? As more new theories emerge, we explore the multiverse in its many permutations. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The multiverse is once again hot stuff. Or perhaps we should say multiverses, given there are a variety of them on the table. Last month, a whole new theory was proposed in an academic journal. Earlier this year, multiverse maverick Max Tegmark released a new tome on the topic. And researchers in Canada and London are joining forces to develop experiments to test for other universes. With us today to discuss the ins and outs of such mind-bending scenarios are Professor David Wallace from the University of Oxford, Dr. Roberto Trotter of Imperial College London, and the Guardian science editor, Ian Sample. First off, and before we delve into the multitude of multiverses, we should talk a bit about our own universe. Roberto, the universe kicked off with the Big Bang, we believe. What does that mean in terms of how far we can see?
Well, we can see in visible light almost all the way until the very beginning. So we now observe with sophisticated telescopes and satellites the very oldest light in the universe, which we call the microwave background. It is a relic radiation, the luminous echo of the Big Bang itself, which stems from the very, very early universe, 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And that's about 13.7 billion years ago. So really, we can see so far out in space, and that means so far back in time, and we can use that relic light to even look further back in time and test for the very, very first fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second after the Big Bang and try to reconstruct what happened then.
Does this put a limit on sort of how far distance-wise we can see out there?
Yes, there is a fundamental limit to any observation we can make in the universe, and that is given by the fact that the speed of light is finite. Light travels at 300,000 kilometers per second. That's about 7.5 times going around the Earth every second. So that's immense as far as we humans are concerned, but the universe is such a big place that light takes a finite amount of time to get to us. And the further out we try to look, the further back in time we see, because it took so many billions of years for light to travel to us. And so given where we are in the cosmic history, we can only look back a certain distance in space because of the time it takes to light to travel to us. And also, you have to factor in the fact that the universe itself is expanding, and that also changes the equation somewhat.
So we can see to a certain distance, which people have said is what, about 42 billion light years or so? It's sort of a fair old distance. I mean, we're not sort of skimping on distance here. But what about what's beyond that? One theory of the multiverse is that there's something beyond that distance. Can we talk a bit about that?
Yes, perhaps just a remark to begin with, which is, if the universe is 13.7 billion years old, then how is it that we can see past that? How is it that we can see further out than 13.7 billion light years? And in fact, we do, and that's because of the expansion of the universe, effectively. So we see further out than 13.7 billion light years, and this could be 40 or 50 or whatever. I mean, we can quibble about the numbers, but it's a bigger number than 13.7 billion sure. light years. Well, what's beyond that? Well, that's a great question. I mean, as if such a universe was not big enough for physicists and cosmologists, we are speculating about the existence of further domains, possibly with different laws of physics, possibly across different dimensions of space that we cannot see, possibly in other places in our own universe that are beyond the horizon. That's the maximum distance we can see. So there are many, many different versions of this multiverse, And one of the challenges is precisely to wrap our head around it. I mean, which multiverse are we talking about even in the first place? And there are multiverses that might be just here with us in this very minute, only we can't observe them. So not all of those places need to be far away in space or time.
How likely is it that beyond the horizon, as you've called it there, that it's just the same? That, in fact, it just goes on and on and on with the same physics and the same, you know, it's just we just can't see it. Is that a possibility?
Well, in a sense, if you're talking about an Occam's razor perspective, that's to say the idea that simple theories are better than complicated theories unless you have very compelling reasons to envisage more complicated models, then from that perspective, a simple universe would be a universe where there's just more of the same. That's the slippery slope argument, as Martin Rees once put it. You know, if there's no reason to believe that anything special happens past the horizon and nothing else past that or past that, past that, and so on to infinity, basically. And our model of the universe, that's supported by wealth of cosmological observations, actually predicts that the universe is flat. That's to say it obeys Euclidean geometry, the kind of geometry we learn in school, and infinite in spatial extent. That's a model of the universe, but there is nothing to say that the physical reality of the universe should conform to that model. We have to remember there is a possible distinction between what reality is and all physical reality is, presumably finite in some sense. And while mathematical, cosmological models of the universe might well predict an infinity that might, for reasons that we do not understand yet, end or change character at a finite distance. The question is, are those speculations purely philosophical or metaphysical in nature, or is there a way that we can make them into testable physical theories? And that's where the science bit comes in.
So one of the questions here is, you know, if we do have universes, other universes, which are different, they don't just keep going from our horizon, there are other concepts here. This sort of calls into question this whole idea of how finely tuned our planet and our universe is. David, do you want to talk a little bit about why that's an interesting concept?
Sure. So our current best theories of physics have about 20 or 30 of what physicists call fundamental constants, numbers that we don't have a theory for where they come from. They're just things we put into the theory from experiment. And the interesting thing about those numbers is in quite a few cases, it seems that if you were to change those numbers just a little bit, then various things that make life possible in our universe stop being possible. So maybe a little change in one of them means stars don't shine, or they shine too hot to support life, or the complex chemical processes that support the evolution just stop working for various reasons. So that seems to mean, if you think about all the possible ways the laws of physics could have been, all the possible ways these parameters could have been chosen, then the actual values seem to be pretty special. They seem to be, if you like, described better by saying, well, they're in the space of values that make life possible than by any more fundamental theory from which they might be derived.
Mm-hmm. This finely tuned nature, how do we try to explain that? I mean, this sort of comes back to the multiverses in the sense that a lot of the other scenarios beyond this idea that the universe just continues in the same way give rise to the possibility that other universes might have different physical constants. How does that get around this question of these constants being so special here on Earth?
Well, try an analogy. We now know of hundreds and hundreds of planets around stars that aren't our sun. And most of those planets seem to be pretty inimical to life. So you might think, well, what an amazing coincidence that we happen to be living on one of the very few planets that supports life. Mm. But of course, that's silly. There are hundreds and hundreds of these planets. There aren't any people on the planets that don't support life, but some of them do support life, and we're on one of those planets. So if it were the case that, taking the same idea on a much larger scale, there were hundreds and hundreds or millions and millions of different universes that differ from each other by the values of these fundamental constants, then most of them would be deserts. Most of them would contain no life or at least no intelligent life. But there'd be so many of them that some of them would contain intelligent life. And so it wouldn't be a mystery that we're living in one of those.
So we wouldn't be very special any longer.
Afraid not.
And so, Roberti, talking about the situations which could give rise to these many, many universes, potentially with different physical constants, there's an idea about bubbles going on. Can you tell me a bit about that? It sounds
quite intriguing. Yeah, inflationary bubbles, and not of the kind that drives up property prices in London. We have to step back a second and talk about inflation, this very first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. What we now have, not conclusive, but very strong evidence for, is that right after the Big Bang, in the first 10 to the minus 32 seconds, if we can imagine how short that time is, something remarkable happened to the universe, which grew from being much smaller than the size of an atom to cosmological scales with a period of accelerated expansion, so a very, very fast expansion of space-time itself. So sometimes we talk about the Big Bang being an explosion into space, but in reality what it is, it's an explosion of space-time itself. And we don't know exactly what drove this incredibly fast expansion. We have theoretical models for quantities and that could be responsible for that. And we call this period of fast expansion inflation. Now, the thing is that according to the particle physics models of what this thing could be that's driving inflation, it's actually quite difficult to stop inflation once it's underway. And so if it starts expanding, as it did, obviously because we're here in our universe, it could be that other periods of inflation have been happening in different parts of the universe, and that would give rise to different bubbles of space-time, if you like, expanding out in different directions. And each of those bubbles would then become an entire universe, just like the one that we see in our case. And so this collection of multiple bubbles in this scenario, which is variously called eternal inflation or chaotic inflation and other technical names, these various bubbles of universes elsewhere, which have been expanded away from our own, would be a collection of possible realization of different universes, each one of them possibly with different constants of the kind that David was mentioning and different laws of physics in a certain sense. And here we go. Then we'd have the analogy, in analogy to what David was saying, instead of having just different planets with different conditions for life or that would be prone to life or not, we have different universes. Each one of them has got certain laws of physics, and we would be forced to live in a universe that's just right for us, a universe that has got the right set of conditions for us as very complex biological beings to emerge. And of course, such conditions would appear to us to be very special, because they are.
And so in a way, you're saying that there are different Big Bangs happening, but do they interact at all? Is that, do these bubbles, is there any way in which we might be aware that there are other universes out there?
Well, that's a great question. In one sense, if we can build enough evidence for the theoretical model underpinning this kind of scenario, and we can probe it by using this relic light from the Big Bang itself, then this would provide us indirect evidence for the existence of these other bubbles. Even though we might not be able to observe them directly, we would know that we would be highly confident that the model that predicts them is right, and then there would be a consequence of that. But more exciting would be if we were ever able to find observational tests, things that we can look up and look for in the sky, and see if those things really exist out there.
And what sort of things are we talking about there? I know that there's been some work at University College London, working with some folks in Canada at the Perimeter Institute. What exactly are they looking at? They're looking again at this cosmic microwave background radiation, but what are they actually doing with that? What are they thinking they're going to see?
So this is a very interesting work that is being done now, and I think it might provide a breakthrough in the way we look for those things. And the idea is that if you want to observe evidence for other bubbles out there, you want to look at the largest possible scales in our universe, as far away, as distant in space and time as you can. And so the relic radiation from the Big Bang is precisely the object that you need to look at. The fundamental idea is that if multiple bubbles exist and of the kind that I described, if they are close enough to one another as they expand, they might bump into each other. And if they do so, they might leave bruises, if you like, on the surface of this sphere of light that surrounds us, that comes from the Big Bang. And so by looking for bruises of this kind in the data that we've obtained from various satellites, those researchers have been able to determine that, at least in the last analysis they did, that if there were such collisions of bubbles, then they have to be less than four collisions. They weren't able to see any strong evidence that they did happen, but if they did happen, then there can't be too many, because we don't see those bruises, or we see hints of them that are not statistically very strong or very conclusive.
What are those signatures? What does it actually look like in the cosmic microwave background when you see something like that?
Well, it's a statistical analysis you have to do, so you can't just look at these maps and pinpoint a location. But they would look like patches of the sky where the temperature of the microwave background is altered from its mean value. And so there would be higher temperature regions in the microwave background that you would then be able to single out. And, of course, statistically, the difficulty is how do we tease apart this weak signature from other things that go on that are perfectly reasonable in terms of our own universe processes. And that's one of the breakthroughs that this team had.
One of the other scenarios that would also potentially get around the anthropic principle or help with that is this idea that, in fact, the universe expands and then contracts and we just have this cycle of big bangs going on. How likely is that, David?
So this very much comes down to what our best understanding of that unknown region is before the, you know, quite far back, 10 to the minus 32 seconds after the Big Bang that we are able to reliably probe with our physics. Our existing best theory of the large general relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, actually predicts that in the very early universe, you can't have the universe contracting and re-expanding, that you reach a singularity and the physics stops. But we know that theory must fail when it gets to extremely short length scales, extremely high densities, and it'll somehow fail and be replaced by some quantum mechanical theory of gravity. The difficulty is we don't know what that theory is yet. So it's possible that theory is compatible with the idea that the universe would expand and contract and expand again. It's possible that the theory wouldn't allow it. We're unsure as to exactly how that would go. There are suggestive ideas, but I think we'd be premature to say there that we can rely on our physics in that territory.
But if I can add one thing in another direction, complementing what you said, David. If you look at our universe, if this idea of a universe that bounces back and forth between a Big Bang and a Big Crunch is right, then we would expect that in the future of our universe, the expansion of the universe will stop and then turn around and a reverse motion version of the Big Bang would happen. But that does not seem to be the case. Our current observations point to the fact that actually the expansion of the universe is not slowing down at all. It's actually accelerating, picking up speed with time, an effect that we ascribe to something mysterious called dark energy, which might or might not have something to do with the inflation that we talked about before. And so it looks very much like we are not going to bounce back. In the sense, we're not going to crash, and actually we're going to keep expanding. And so if this is true, then it would seem extremely implausible that we were, as we were, the last bounce of this bouncing universe is. And so probably this idea is not compatible with what we see in our universe, at least.
So moving on to perhaps the most mind-boggling of all the possible multiverse interpretations is something called the Everett idea. What's this all about, the Everett interpretation, David? I know this is your hot topic.
The Everett interpretation is what I think is our best way of understanding quantum mechanics, which is our best theory of the very small, our best theory of electrons and atoms and subatomic particles. And so because the world around us is made out of electrons and atoms and subatomic particles, quantum theory is really our best theory of pretty much everything. And it's a spectacularly successful theory, but it's got a sort of scandal in it, which is that we don't really know how to make sense of it as a description of the world. It seems to say things like, well, electrons are here and there at the same time, or atoms are spinning this way and that way at the same time. And that's at least weird. But of course, you might say, well, we'd expect to find the microscopic world weird. But the theory also says, or seems to say, that when we make measurements, observations of an electron that's here and here at the same time, we detect it to be in one place and another place at the same time. In Schrödinger's famous, if not terribly ethical, thought experiment, if we imagine that we measure where the electron is and we kill a cat if it's in one place and we don't kill a cat if it's in the other place, the cat's alive and dead at the same time. And people have thought that, well, that makes no sense, and so we'll need to modify the theory in various ways to remove this simultaneous alive and deadness of the cat. But the problem is that the theory is actually pretty good, and that's a huge understatement. The theory is spectacularly successful, and modifying it turns out to be very, very difficult. What Hugh Everett said about 60 years ago is, well, let's take seriously the idea that the cat is alive and dead at the same time and ask what that would mean. And 50 years of work since then has made it pretty clear that what it would mean, if we take it literally, is that there's one chunk of physical reality describing a cat that is alive, and there's another chunk of physical reality present in the same space but not interacting with the first chunk, in which the cat is dead. So we have two parallel streams of goings on. In one stream, the cat's dead, I mourn the cat, the cat's death is reported in The Observer. In the other stream, the cat lives, we celebrate, The Observer has a happier story on the front page. These streams, effectively, not at a fundamental level, but at the level of observations, cats and dogs and chairs and tables, are parallel worlds. And so quantum theory is telling us, if you take it seriously, according to the Everett interpretation, that we constantly have branching into parallel universes going on all around us, not just in distant pieces of the sky, but actually in the space we inhabit ourselves.
This is a kind of very interesting idea. It's on an early on a worry Thursday morning. It's quite mind-boggling. But does this mean, when you talk about an observation, are we talking here about, you know, whether I choose tea or coffee in one universe I've chosen tea, in the other universe I've chosen coffee? Are we talking about sort of a different sort of observations? What do we mean when we say an observation?
Yes, we're talking about observations of the quantum mechanical world, or perhaps more generally, scalings up of the weirdness and indeterminacy of the quantum mechanical world to the large scale. So, for instance, I always have coffee in the morning. So I should think it's a deterministic fact about my brain that I'm going to ask for coffee in the morning. And so my asking for coffee is not going to split. There isn't another branch in which I have some tea. It might be that your decision to have coffee or tea in the morning is the merest whim. And it could be that whim really does come down to the amplification of some microscopic indeterministic process in the neurons of your brain that means it really is the case that it's genuinely, in the strongest sense, random as to which of tea and coffee you have. In which case, according to quantum theory, there really are branches where you might have tea or you might have coffee. We don't know that. It comes down to questions of neuroscience. We do know that there are lots of processes in the natural world, lots of chaotic processes, which scale up small indeterminacies very quickly. The weather, we know, for instance, is a chaotic process. And so we've got excellent reasons to think that, because we've got very strong reasons to think that what the weather's like now depends on very fine-grained features of the physics of where the particles in the sky were a few weeks ago, that since where those particles were in the sky a few weeks ago was quantum mechanically indeterminate to a small degree, that actually what the weather's like today is going to be different in different branches. I mean, there probably aren't parallel worlds in which the weather in London in November is glorious, alas. But more generally, that just mundane things like that are things where we would expect them to be different across different branches of the quantum multiverse.
Can I just ask something about what this actually means in reality? So what actually do you mean by a branch? Does that constitute the creation of another universe? If it does, what does that mean? I mean, I struggle with a lot of the terminology as to what is actually happening and what constitutes a split, as we've been talking about. But what does it really mean for this to happen?
So at the fundamental level, there isn't really any splitting going at all. At the fundamental level, the world is just quantum mechanical, and our ordinary classical language, the language that we've sort of developed to handle ordinary middle-scale goings-on, is just not capable of describing what the quantum reality is like fundamentally, and we more or less have to fall back to the mathematics. What we're talking about here is how we can describe the processes emergently at higher levels. At a higher level, it turns out that if we want to see how our classical concepts of tables and chairs and cats and dogs emerge from that quantum mechanical, mysterious, fundamental reality, then they emerge multiply. So we find that in physics jargon, certain collective degrees of freedom, certain descriptions of systems at a large scale, turn out to tell us that there are simultaneously multiple parallel sets of large-scale goings-on. But it's not written into the equations at the most fundamental level. So by an analogy, Earth and Mars are different worlds, but they're not different worlds because the laws of physics tell us fundamentally that there must be Earth and there must be Mars. As far as the laws of physics are concerned, there are just the particles that make up the solar system, and it's an emergent, a higher level fact that they happen to be organized in such a way that there's one relatively cohesive, strongly interacting system, Earth, where the things happening on one bit of the Earth influence the things happening on another bit of the Earth quite a lot. And there's another such set of goings on Mars, but that, at least until NASA and the European Space Agency came along, there wasn't very much interaction between the goings on the surface of the Earth and the surface of Mars. That's why we call those worlds. They're chunks of reality that basically don't interact with each other very much as a matter of just the way contingent goings-on have happened.
In your example where you had your cat dying or surviving, does that require a creation of a new you? Or did that new you and the new cat already exist? Or, and if so, where are they?
So it's almost a matter of language whether we decide to talk about there having been parallel goings-on that just become different from one another, or whether there's a single set of going-on that branch. I think the latter description is usually more helpful. So in that sense, yes, there will be different versions of me coming into existence. Not really even two. It's not a number that you can easily count or quantify, but there will be many different streams of my experience and consciousness happening. And as for why we can't interact with them, the sort of simple and boring answer is really, well, that's what the physics tells us. The equations of quantum mechanics have parallelism written very deeply into their mathematical DNA. And that means that, in general, when the equations describe multiple sets of goings-on at the macroscopic level, then they will tend to interact with other goings-on. That parallelism will spread out in a way that makes it very difficult for physics to engineer the quite delicate phenomena which we call interference, which actually allows the different parallel goings-on in quantum mechanics to get in each other's way in a way that we can detect.
So we've talked a bit about how the cosmic microwave background radiation has been sort of, it was going to be probed for idea of these sort of bumping bubbles in the other version of the multiverse. That sort of one sort of experiment, is there any experiment that we could do to probe whether there are indeed these sort of sliding doors type scenarios going on out there? Is there any way we can test this?
It's not something we can test directly, in the sense that there won't realistically ever be an experiment where you can talk to your parallel self, at least unless we're completely wrong about the way the physics works in some way we haven't thought of yet. What there are experiments to do is to test further and further the prediction that this sort of thing is happening at what physicists call the mesoscopic level, the level between macro and micro. So the experiments that show us quantum parallelism are experiments where we actually are able to beat the odds and allow one branch of reality at a small scale to interfere with and interact with another branch of reality. We used to only be able to do that with light and with single particles. We're now able to do it with Buckminster fullerene, which, as you know, is a chemical compound with 60 carbon atoms, with hundreds of microscopic particles. We can show that Buckminster fullerene can be placed in one of these strange quantum states where it's doing two separate things at the same time. And then we can bring those two separate states into interference and show that that must have been what's going on. And there's no hard limit as to how far we can push those experimental results. As a general rule, people who have bet against the ingenuity of experimental physicists have not recovered their money. The other thing to say about testing it is that very often in physics, we're confronted with claims that we're never directly going to test, but that are inescapable consequences of the physics we have. So our ordinary classical universe cosmology, for instance, makes lots of claims about what's happening on the beaches of the planets orbiting the stars in incredibly distant galaxies. Not so distant that light never reaches us from them, but far, far too distant for us to ever have any chance of seeing any more of that whole galaxy than just a point of light in the sky. Far too far away for us to think that we'll ever see those beaches and the grains of sand on those beaches. But because the theory as a whole is so successful, and because we couldn't remove those worlds from the theory without mutilating it, Occam's razor, which is sometimes used to suggest that we should just reduce the amount of stuff in the universe, but really tells us that we should reduce the amount of complexity in the universe, tells us that we should believe what our theories tell us about those distant beaches on alien worlds, even though we'll never see them and never travel to them. And very much the same argument can be advanced to argue why we should take seriously what quantum mechanics is telling us about those sliding doors scenarios, even in situations where we'll never directly see them and get to them.
Well, it sounds like there are lots of different ideas out there for trying to explain this concept of the multiverse. Is there one particular one that has drawn a stronger consensus than the others? I mean, these all sound very, very different. Is there any sort of consensus amongst the scientific community?
I think there is no sort of consensus on which one, if any, of those many different paradigms might be true or even testable in the near future, There is a growing unease in the community, certainly in the sense that people are becoming more conscious of the fact that some of those things need explanation, that there is something that needs explaining or clarifying or understanding. So let me bring in the A word here, which is the anthropic word. So this idea that our universe is strangely fine-tuned for life, as we discussed earlier, which goes back all the way to Weinberg in the 80s when he pointed out that the expansion of the universe could not be accelerating too much, because if it was, our galaxy would not be able to form. The space-time expansion would rip the formation of structure apart before it could proceed. So with no galaxy, we have no stars, we have no planets, we have no life. And so he made a quote-unquote prediction that Einstein's cosmological constant, if there is such a thing, that's one of the numbers that describes the fundamental nature of the universe, could not be larger than a certain amount, because otherwise we wouldn't be here to talk about it. And famously, 20 years later, observations of distant explosions of stars in the universe have actually shown that there is indeed a cosmological constant in the universe, and the value of that constant is below the limit that Weinberg had predicted. And so this is another example, perhaps the most striking example of these fine-tunings that we have talked about. While the cosmological constant is non-zero, it's incredibly small compared to the back-of-the-envelope predictions that our highly successful quantum mechanical theories make. So small, in fact, that the probability of us living in a universe with such a small cosmological constant is about the same probability as getting 400 heads in a row. Okay, so 400 heads in a row, it's a very difficult one to pull off. And so that cries out for an explanation of some sort, and whether it's anthropic, that's to say a probabilistic statistical argument of the kind that we discussed, namely there are many, many kinds of universes and each one of them will have a different cosmological constant and we are bound to be in one of those or such universes where the cosmological constant is small enough for us to be here, or whether there is something else, whether we don't understand something at a more fundamental level about either the cosmological observations or the makeup of quantum reality. Well, that is the question. I think the physics community is awakening very much this question, and there is a growing consensus that there is something that cries out for an explanation.
So a question for both of you is that some of these multiverse models give rise to sort of other selves, identical versions of each of us, or maybe not identical versions, but with the Everett interpretation, there'll be other Davids with a cat or without a cat, and in another multiverse where there would just be pockets of space beyond our own, there'll be another Roberto, a long way away, presumably. Does this change how we should see ourselves? Does this change any notions that we might have of free will or how a moral responsibility? If I know that whatever I do here, there's another guy in another universe who's behaved better or worse, or I don't know how this changes how I should see myself in a way.
I think in the immediate term, it doesn't really change anything. The branchings that are happening here are happening because of quantum mechanical effects. It's not simply determined, as in science fiction sometimes, by my own choices. So if I make a choice to do the right thing, there's no particular reason to think that there is a branch of reality that just branches off where I do the wrong thing. I'd like to think that when I make the right choice, I do it for reasons rather than just because of some random quantum mechanical process. But there is a sense in which it makes a broader difference. I think when we discovered that the Earth went round the sun and we discovered that the lights in the sky were other stars, that didn't directly change morality and life and love, but of course it told us that our place in the cosmos was very different from what we thought it was. And of course that has influenced our self-conception and our culture and the way we think of our species immeasurably. And I think in the longer term, it's highly possible to imagine that these steps will have similar effects.
Roberto, do you ever think about the other Robertos out there?
Well, certainly when I'm having too much pasta, I think maybe there's somebody else out there that has got one less serving, perhaps. But I think David is right. It's a wider cultural implications here that are of importance. And the fact that we ourselves are understanding more and more as science progresses that our place in the universe is not so special. You know, just one of the planets going around the sun, one of the stars among billions in our galaxy, our own galaxy, one among 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe alone. And perhaps even that is just a tiny fraction of a much larger reality of the multiverse. And so the wider implication is that we are tiny compared to the fundamental reality. And if there are multiple copies of us or multiple versions of us in any one of those different realizations of the multiverse, that reduces even more our relative importance. By contrast, though, in a sense, this makes it even more astonishing that such a minuscule and insignificant species has risen to being capable of understanding a large fraction of what goes on in the universe and in the quantum world. And that's one astonishing fact about that says something about us as humans.
Is there any possibility, and I know that some people have proposed, that perhaps we're overlooking the fact that it could all just be chance? Is that something which you think has got a leg to stand on?
I don't know. I think one coincidence is suspicious, two coincidences is strange, and three coincidences, I don't believe in them. Right? So if those things pile up, I think they're really pointing towards something of fundamental nature that we do not understand. So, and physicists do not believe in coincidences. And every time we've seen strange things popping up, little experimental facts, for example, the turning of last century, the photoelectric effect seemed to be just a little quirk, something that nobody could understand, and that led later to the development of quantum mechanics and a complete revolution the way we look at the universe. So all those strange things in cosmology and in quantum mechanics that we do not understand might have the keys, actually, to a revolution in our understanding of the fundamental nature, both of the macro and the micro universe.
It's also worth remembering that these multiverse hypotheses are not, by and large, rival hypotheses. The idea that we might live in a cosmological multiverse because of inflation, and the idea that we might live in a sliding doors multiverse through quantum mechanics, come from different arguments, and it's entirely possible for both to be true. In fact, the physics we use to describe the cosmological multiverse is quantum theory, and it's exactly the theory that also leads us to take seriously the idea of, in your term, a sliding doors multiverse.
But David, isn't this just postulating something quite sort of incredible, just to sort of try and answer this question of why things seem so special where we are?
I think if that was the only reason we were doing it, then yes, it would be a pretty ad hoc, pretty unsatisfactory move. I mean, rather similarly to supposing we didn't understand why there was life on Earth and we just invented the universe of all the different galaxies to solve the problem. But of course, that's not the situation we're in. The situation we are in is that our theories independently give us pretty strong reason to expect there to be a multiverse. Theories that are, in the case of quantum mechanics, extremely solid. In the case of cosmology, speculative but pretty well developed and with an increasing bound of evidence. And those theories seem very strongly to tell us that there needs to be a multiverse, quite apart from the fine-tuning argument. So once we already know that there is a multiverse, it's then a bonus that the fine-tuning argument looks like it probably goes away in that multiverse, or at least we get a tool to solve it, which we didn't expect. But it's not a tool we gave ourselves just for the purposes of solving the problem. It's a tool we had anyway.
So perhaps my final question is maybe a slightly contentious one, but to what degree is this a science and to what degree is this metaphysics, this whole, any of these notions of multiverses? Which side would you come down on?
It might not be fully testable science yet, but as our knowledge progresses and the ingenuity of both theoretical and experimental physicists increases, it might well become testable in the near future. And so it's a paradigm that we need to explore and explore it fully. And I think people are focusing on doing just that. And I think that's the way forward. And if it's not hardcore science quite yet because of the lack of observable ways of probing it, it might become so in the future. And so we should definitely be pursuing this.
And David?
Quantum mechanics is absolutely science, and it's about as good as science gets and about as solid as science gets. And I think exploring the conceptual space of our most solid science is itself science. Trying to understand what the world is like according to a scientific theory is science, if anything, science. For the multiverses that we might be led to consider through cosmology, then I agree with Roberto. This is the beginning of something which may turn out not to become science, or to become, if you like, science that wasn't right, but at the moment seems to be showing perfectly promising signs of being a science in development.
Well, from this universe at least, that's all we have time for this week. Professor David Wallace, thank you very much. Dr. Roberto Trotta, thank you very much for coming in. We'll see you again next week.